Welcome to the Emerging Minds podcast.
Hi, I'm Alicia Ranford and you're listening to an Emerging Minds Families podcast. Before we begin today's episode, we would like to pay respect to the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is recorded, the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We also pay respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, their ancestors and elders, past, present and emerging from the different First Nations across Australia. When we're little, we have no inhibitions. We aren't born knowing what it means to be self-conscious. The true joy of watching children run under a sprinkler or dancing around the house dressed in a tutu and a toy fireman's hat, it's very hard not to be captivated and delighted by a children's innocence. They don't judge or see shame in anyone's bodies. They just want to dance and laugh and have fun. But somewhere along the way, we know that this changes. Today, we're talking to Dr. Zali Yeager. Zali is an internationally recognised expert in body image with a background in health and physical education. She co-authored the book Embrace Kids with the 2023 Australian of the Year, Taryn Bromfitt, and was the expert advisor on the Embrace Kids film. She's also co-founder of the Embrace Collective, a not-for-profit organisation leading the charge of a global body image movement to create safer body image environments for our children and young people. Welcome, Zali. I'm so thrilled to be sitting down with you today to talk about such an important subject.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zali, you have been researching and exploring body image for over 20 years now. How did you first become interested in this space?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I guess I went to university to study to become a health and physical education teacher. And this is kind of the first time that I remember being interested in it was whenever there was an option to choose a topic to develop a lesson on or to do a presentation on, I would always choose body image. And I just became known as the person that would just choose that topic, I guess. And later in life, when I'm now a little bit more reflective, I can realize that that's because I had my own personal experience of kind of feeling like I was in a larger body when I was a young child, and then the people around me kind of making it quite clear that that was not okay. And sort of then having that dissatisfaction and going through disordered eating and all of that sort of thing, and in my adolescence, which kind of is what led me to go and become a health and PE teacher as well. But yeah, my own personal experience, and then I guess I call it my learned experience as well of being in that health space. Really, I just kind of got to the point where I thought, you know, we could be doing so much better. It doesn't have to be this way. And that's kind of been the story ever since.
And your story is so similar to so many people, and in particular women out there all around the world.
Yeah, and that's why I guess I didn't talk about it for a long time because I was like, oh, it's just the same as everyone else. But then it was kind of that point where I was like, but it shouldn't be the same for everyone. You know, we don't have to feel this way about our bodies. We don't have to feel all of this pressure. And that's kind of what led me then to create an organisation that has a vision for changing that.
And when we talk about body image, can you really explain to our listeners what you mean by this?
Yeah, and it's a really tricky term. Not a lot of people understand it. So if you don't know what it is, then that's fine. But when we're talking about body image, it's really just the way you feel about the way you look. So it's not your actual appearance. It's not how you actually look in the mirror. It's kind of how you feel about it and the things that you would do as a result. So it's that internal picture. And I say, I have identical twin girls, and I say they both look very much the same, except we did cut their hair to be kind of different, just so we could tell who was who. But they look very much the same, but they will have a very different internal idea of how they look and whether that's okay or not.
So it's really that internal dialogue that we have with ourselves.
Yeah, and because it's inside people, it's very hard to see how they do feel about themselves, which does make it challenging when we are raising our kids, looking after clients, working with students. Like, it's very hard to tell how people feel about themselves. And that's why we kind of have to, I guess, have enough resources available so that we can keep people on that kind of feeling good side most of the time.
Yes. And I think that's a really important point that you make, is that we can never tell how someone's feeling about themselves in their internal talk and what they're saying to themselves. So is that why it's so important that we be having these conversations around body image?
Yeah, and I just think the more that we can understand this area in general, the more that we can kind of as the grown-ups in the room, reflect on our own journey and maybe the things that might have made us feel not so great about ourselves, and then start to just become okay to ask those curious questions. I think that when we approach this in just a really non-judgmental way, we're not freaking out about it. We're just like, oh, tell me more about that. I just think that the more informed you are, the closer we get to really understanding what's going on for young people. And it's such a good point. You know, you can't tell, we always say you can't tell by looking at someone how they feel about their body and what they might be thinking about doing in terms of dieting, disordered eating, all of that sort of thing.
What does the research tell us about children and body image and how their depiction of their body image perhaps changes over time?
I could talk for a long time about this, but I guess it was many years ago now. In Melbourne, I was part of a study where we were doing interviews with 3 to 5 year olds, and it was a play-based interview. We would sit and sort of read a story and talk about someone's broken this vase, which child broke the vase, and they would have to point at a picture of a child, and they were sort of in different sized bodies. And what we found was that the 3-year-olds already had really clear ideas that it was the child in the larger body that had broken the vase, that didn't have any friends, that think of any negative kind of, you know, social situation. And there was already that, just that categorization and what we would call kind of weight stigma when it's in an adult. But there were already those rigid ideas about that thin is basically good and that fat is basically bad from that very early age. And what we know about that is that if that continues over time and that becomes the internal story that young people are telling themselves, then if their body is growing larger just because of the way that their genetics kind of mean that they will be, then they start to think that they're not a good person because that's kind of that internal categorization and rigidity that they might have. So that's a very long way of answering the question, but basically it starts much earlier than you think that young people start to have those ideas. By the time they get to around 9, developmentally, they start to compare themselves to their peers. So they start to look at their own body, compare that to other people, compare that to media and what they see. And then we see that around 14, 15 is kind of still that key time for eating disorders, but the rates of eating disorders in 5 to 9 year olds has doubled. So it is starting to be seen a lot younger as well.
Wow, that is so fascinating that from such an early age, even young children who seemingly are carefree and, as a mother myself, I think not thinking about those sorts of things, clearly the messages are getting through to them about this. And I heard from what you're saying that it's not just from home, it's about social, it's about media and the way we're portraying people in the media. Is that right?
Yeah, so we would typically say that parents or families, peers and the media are the 3 key influences. And back 20 years ago when I started, those 3 things were distinct and separate. But now with social media, we kind of see that the peer influence and the media influence is very much blended together. But families are still the key influence on young people's body image. You know, we think up until that age of like 9 or 10, and then it does start to switch over. And so a lot of parents kind of feel very much like this is something that you just put in that basket of things I can't control. But actually, there are 10 years of those very early influences where young people are soaking up all of the attitudes and all of the things that they hear from us, even when we don't think that we're teaching them things. So they're soaking all of that up across those early years. And then it does start to become something that social media influences much more.
So what can parents be doing right from birth to make sure that we're talking about this in the right way and projecting the right thinking and feeling about body image to our children?
So I think that the main thing that we can do is actually to stop speaking about our own bodies in certain ways. And even just by becoming a little bit more aware of the things that we're saying about our bodies, about other people's bodies, and even the unspoken things, the face that you might pull in the mirror while you're trying something on, those are the sorts of things that really from a very early age, we want to just practice just kind of being a little bit kinder to ourselves and really talking about the functionality of our bodies instead of what our bodies look like. Because overall, then, if we're saying less negative things about our body, that's a really direct role modeling of attitudes. But then also, if we're just talking about, oh, I really love my legs are so strong because it meant that I could run after you into the ocean today, saying those little things, then I think they do build up over time and kind of gives our kids this idea that actually you're so much more than what you look like, because you're here and you're doing things, you're being a whole human in the world, and just the outer shell part is not as important as some people may think it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that message. And I was listening to a podcast by your colleague, Taryn, and one of the wonderful things that she said, which is very similar to what you said, is about arms, and that these are the arms that embrace my family and tell them that I love them. And I think that that language around your body is just such a beautiful thing to be teaching children from such a young age.
Yeah, and all of the research in this space shows that appreciating our body functionality is going to be so helpful in improving body image. And a lot of that is something that we do need to practice ourselves, because as people who have grown up through the 80s and 90s, we were really subjected to some pretty horrific negative attitudes around bodies. And there's a lot of unlearning that we have to do. And part of that is just thinking about those areas of ourselves that we think should be, and I'm doing inverted commas because this is audio, but, you know, we think it should be a certain way. But then actually did a lot of this work with mothers after they'd given birth, just actually being so appreciative of their stomach, even though it didn't like look how it should look, because of the things that it was able to bring into the world. And it's just that whole perspective of the function and the things that our body's actually here for. It's not here just for show, you know.
That's a great point. I feel like it's important we have conversations with other people who are caring for our kids as well, because they did grow up in a different generation where the body image was spoken about in such a different way. How do you think parents can do this without shaming that older generation?
Yeah, it's a really tough one, because we get asked this a lot, actually. People say, well, I'm doing the right thing, but I just can't stop my great aunt from saying these things. And I think that I've tried to create different resources for grandparents to be like, you know, things have changed. We don't really talk about stuff like that anymore. And I think that it can just be about, you know, I think they understand that the world is moving on and some things you don't say anymore. So I think you can just put it like that. But then also I think once our kids get to a certain age where, and it's the age where they might start to take those things on a little bit more around, you know, 9 and up. But if someone says something, you don't have to have this great big moment at the time. I never know what to say in those moments either. And so normally it will be after I've had a little think about it, and I'm, you know, maybe in the car home, you're just like, oh, do you remember when so-and-so said that thing today? And they'll be like, yeah. And then you're just like, that's not really what I think. Or you can just unpack it a little bit and really make sure that what they're taking away from the situation is what you would have rather that person said.
Absolutely. And important to be having those conversations, because from your experience and all the research that you've done, what do we know about the relation between body image and mental health and well-being?
This is something that's only happened really recently, that we've got this, some really big studies all came out and said basically the same thing a couple of years ago, which was that actually there is a really strong relationship between body dissatisfaction or feeling not so good about your body and depression. And so prior to that, people sort of thought body image was just this kind of like superficial thing, and that if you didn't like the way you looked, then that wasn't such a big deal. But we just have such strong evidence now that actually they are related, and usually it's the body dissatisfaction that will come first. So the negative feelings about the body actually predicted the onset of depressive symptoms. And the statistic is that young people who are dissatisfied with their bodies are actually 24 times more likely to experience depression. And that's kind of depression at the same time as body dissatisfaction. But I guess it just really, it does really kind of bring home how important this issue is and why it does need to be considered in the context of mental health in general, because for a long time it was kind of seen as a separate thing.
What can parents do who recognise that perhaps they haven't been talking about their bodies or body image in their family in a way that now they perhaps might like to? What would you say to those families who perhaps now wanted to take a different approach from hearing our conversation today?
Yeah, and I think it is just about, you can't be perfect overnight, and so that's, we always say this is a no shoulds, no shame approach. We don't want to make people feel bad about people, making people feel bad. You know, it's just this whole cycle. So I do think that just becoming aware of it is definitely the first step. And even if you are still saying the the negative things about your own body, which can be hard to change after 40 or 50 years of living in it. Even if you're saying that, if you're a little bit aware of it, you can actually come back around in that later conversation, be like, oh, remember earlier when I said this, what I actually meant was that I was just feeling really frustrated with my situation. So you can kind of explain a little bit more about the context. I always try to talk about Red Riding Hood approach, which is if your child comes up and pokes your belly or something and it's wobbly. And so normally you'd say something self-deprecating like, and then they're like, why is it so wobbly? And you're like, well, because you were in there, like because I ate a lot of cake or something. If that's what you would normally say and you can stop yourself halfway through, then you can add in something about functionality. So it's because I was eating a lot of cake or, you know, had a big dinner or something. And also I really appreciate that this is the space that I was able to carry you in. And it's a very different kind of feeling then, so that young people can sort of take away, well, there's function and there's appearance, and one isn't necessarily more important than the other. So it is a process to kind of start to recognize those things and catch yourself, I guess. And in a society where the way that bodies have been spoken about for such a long time has been so negative, particularly larger bodies, then it's really hard to steer the ship, but it's really worth it to steer the ship.
What terminology should we be using about our bodies in terms, I've heard you say larger bodies, smaller bodies. What is the right way? Or should we just, like you said, not be talking about the size of a person's body?
Yeah, it's hard. There's no right answer. But what we do know now is that some terms for people's bodies are quite stigmatizing because they have a negative connotation that's been attached to them over time. And so words like, you know, overweight, obese, are kind of medical categorization terms, and that's kind of what they were intended to be, but then they've sort of filtered into regular language and can be used in a really negative way. So in general, if we're using any words and they do have that negative feeling behind them, then we could stop and reflect on whether we really need to be saying that. But it's hard because sometimes you might need to use medical terms, then you can use them in that context. If you're referring to the research around that space, you can use them in that context. But I just generally prefer like people living in larger bodies or people in larger bodies if I need to talk about that. And then the kind of opposite is true as well, like people in smaller bodies kind of works. In general, it's just a lot less emotive, a bit more neutral, which is kind of what we're aiming for.
Absolutely. And I feel like the culmination of your life's work seems to have led you to starting the Embrace Collective. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how that came about?
Yeah, I was a researcher and had been for quite some time working so hard trying to figure out what worked to help people feel better about their bodies. But I'd never really thought about what would happen if I found something. And it got to the point where I was on a bus and I was doing all this work on, you know, women in the postpartum period and their body image. And I was talking to this man. He's like, my wife's just had a baby. She's really struggling. What can you give me for that? And I was just like, oh, well, I wrote some papers for other researchers. And he kind of looked at me and I was like, oh, I've got nothing to actually help people, which was what I'd kind of gone into the whole thing aiming to do. And so really started to think about, actually, we do know enough in the research and in the science so far. We had 20, 30 years that we could start to tell people some things that could actually start to make a difference. And so in the Embrace Collective, the aim is really just to kind of create this world where all of the things that happened to us, all of those things that that person said at school, all of the things that happened when that teacher did a lesson or when that grandparent said something, if we could just make those things not happen, then we could create this world where people don't feel so much shame about their bodies. And our current focus is on really arming all of those people around the young people, the educators, the parents, the sports coaches. We've just gone for those people who interact with young people most days and tried to arm them with the resources to be able to create an environment that just feels more safe and supportive for young people around their bodies, so that we're not saying things that might trigger any sort of shame. We're not allowing any sort of appearance-based bullying, commentary, teasing, shaming, all of that sort of stuff to happen between peers. And I just think about all the things I would love to erase from the environment that we grew up in, and that's what we're trying to create as the future for our kids.
What's available to parents and teachers through the Embrace Collective?
We're currently busily creating a whole range of resources where we're really translating all of that research and evidence into actual fun, creative things that people might want to engage with. And this is where Karen and myself coming together, we really started to realise, hey, there's something in this, because I was trying to make things that were really dry and based on science and no one actually wanted to look at them. And then Taryn has this way of really engaging people, communicating and really making people feel things as well as learn things. And through all of the resources we've been able to create together, the first one, you know, I advised on the Embrace Kids film, and that's something that actually people don't even know that they're learning something because they're so engaged, entertained along the way. So we're creating all of these resources. We've got for educators, a lot of that is available already. We have the Embrace Kids Classroom program, that's for year 5 and 6 and year 7 and 8 kids. And that really takes the best of that film and breaks it into classroom pieces. We also have a teacher masterclass, and the aim of that is really, it's a very short 15-minute video. A lot of the time, the teachers that would come to our professional learning sessions are the one teacher in the school who's really passionate about this, and they're going to be the champion. And what we're asking is that that champion might take this video to their staff meeting and play that for all of the teachers. Because if all of the teachers can just understand this really small snapshot around, you know, some of the language shifts that we might need to make, and some of the changes to the Australian curriculum that might inform the activities that we do around food, bodies, weight and health, then it's just going to make such a difference across the whole school. We have for early childhood educators a program that they can engage with. There's 7 5-minute videos. So it's a total of 30 minutes to just have a look at how they can really start right back at the beginning, you know, with those 3-year-olds or even the 0-year-olds, and how to build those positive relationships with food, bodies, right from the very beginning. And then for parents, we have a mini masterclass. Parents told us, I can't listen to hours of content. I don't have time for all of this. So we've made it 3 minutes. And I did this survey once with parents and I was like, how long could something be? And when do you have time pockets in your day? And the mothers were like, I have about 60 seconds and it's when I'm on the toilet. And someone answered the survey saying, I'm on the toilet right now answering this survey. So we've tried to make it something that you don't have to listen to it in the bathroom, but
you can if you want to.
It's that kind of length of time. It's like I've pulled up at school pickup and I've got roughly 3 minutes and 59 seconds. You've got enough time to watch the masterclass. So we've really brought it together and, yeah, again, just tried to pack it all in. Very exciting Embrace magazine where we've really, again, instead of because we wrote a book, like this, you kind of have to write it all down in a book. And that came out a few years ago, but then it's like, oh, all of those words. How can we actually show people instead of telling people? So we've really focused on bringing those stories to life. And I'm really excited about the magazine. It's a very exciting resource for parents. We've just tried to create things that we would want to engage with and that we can really break down that information. And the magazine as well is something that I really think that we also kind of created that because it's like you can pass that on to that great aunt. You can pass it on to the grandparents like, oh, you're babysitting today. You might want to read this. So it's very shareable. And I think that any of these things that mean that more people can just understand, like once we get that critical mass of people not saying the things, not doing the things, then that's when we're going to see that sort of generational shift.
And where can families access the magazine?
Everything for everyone is accessible through bodyimageresources.com. And if you tick the box to say you're a parent, then you'll get sent things around parenting. If you tick the box to say you're a sports coach, then you'll get sent those things. So make sure you tick all the boxes that relate to you and your situation. And then we'll send you everything. Everything is free this year. So we really just want to get things out to as many people as possible.
And for anyone who hasn't already seen it, I would really encourage you to go out and watch Embrace Kids. It's fantastic. It's fantastic to watch with your children as well. It is free on some streaming services, so a quick Google can tell you where to find that. So for practitioners listening, what could be some useful advice for discussing body image with the families and children in their care?
When I speak to practitioners, I always talk about the fact that this might not have been something that you've learned about at university, but if you are working with children and young people in relation to their bodies, if you're physio, even like OT, all that, like the way that young people feel about their bodies is going to impact how they show up at that session, how they engage with the treatment protocol. And it's just something, I guess, to be aware of. But also the advice is very consistent across the board in terms of just the way that we speak about bodies and trying to make sure that we're not inadvertently creating any situations where young people might feel shame about their weight or about their body size and shape. And so with depends what space practitioners are in, but really thinking about protocols where they do have to weigh young people and whether that's actually necessary and whether they could investigate a system where young people might not see the numbers on the scale. There's a whole lot of different considerations around weighing young people, but really just trying to make sure that when we're talking about bodies, we're not talking about that high weight would be necessarily a bad thing and that low weight is always a good thing.
What's important for educators and practitioners to understand about the research and what we know about children and young people and body image?
I guess the main thing to really understand, a lot of practitioners, a lot of educators are really on the lookout for eating disorders, and that's really right at the end of the continuum, whereas a lot can be, there's a lot of things that we can recognise and look for that sort of come back down that continuum so that we can be engaging more in prevention and in an early intervention kind of space. And I think that when we're looking for the signs of young people kind of just being really uncomfortable with or dissatisfied with their body, trying to hide their body, then that's something that we should start to be picking up on as well. In terms of how body image develops over time, a lot of practitioners don't really realise that this is something that develops from a very early age and that actually, you know, we do have research with sort of the 3, 4, 5-year-olds that shows that there is already potentially some dissatisfaction there and some really rigid ideas around body weight. But then that sort of starts to become stronger around the age of 9. So at 9, young people have the developmental capacity to compare themselves to others, and they start to compare in a whole range of things, but one of them is the size of their body, the shape of their body, and how that compares to the societal kind of, in inverted commas, idealized standards. So I guess that there is a lot that we can do in terms of prevention of body dissatisfaction and eating disorders, disordered eating. And sometimes it does come down to, you know, putting in additional programs, things that are evidence-based programs that are going to teach young people to really question those societal standards and, you know, become more critical consumers of the media. But sometimes it's also about taking out some things. And I talk a lot about prevention in the school space. And if we can change some of the activities that we're doing in relation to food and nutrition, then that's actually going to have a huge preventive effect in terms of a lot of those activities are really problematic for potentially developing eating disorders and disordered eating behaviour and attitudes.
I understand within the national curriculum, there's been some changes around food and nutrition and potentially body image. Could you talk to us a little bit more about that?
This was, you know, in 2023, the Embrace Collective collaborated with Eating Disorder Families Australia, and we were really led by a parent of a young girl with an eating disorder. Her name's Kylie, and she came to us at the start of last year, and her story is that, you know, her daughter had been in treatment for an eating disorder and then had gone back to school, and the first lesson of maths was a measurement unit, and maybe someone thought they were trying to make maths fun by making it relatable by making them measure their bodies. And so they had to measure body parts, they had to weigh themselves, they had to compare weights on charts, they had to calculate BMI, they had to do all of these things in maths. And so that really led to her daughter's relapse, and she ended back up in hospital. So just a really problematic maths unit. And Kylie reached out to us and just said, what can we do about this? And this is something that I've been doing a lot of research on for 10 years, trying to tell teachers, you know, let's not do those things. Let's not weigh people in class. Let's not calculate BMI. Let's not compare ourselves to others in class. So we came together and we had all of the research to show that those things were problematic. It's US and Canadian research, but they did two different studies of people who were just being admitted for treatment for anorexia nervosa. And in both studies, 14% of their case notes mentioned food, nutrition, education as a direct trigger of anorexia nervosa. And when you think about things like recording everything that you eat for a week and coming up with the things that you're going to not eat the next week, you know, a lot of traditional food and nutrition education is around restriction. And it's hugely problematic for really vulnerable young people who are in that developmental stage of trying to figure out who they are and how they look and how their body's changing and all of that sort of thing. So we came together, we wrote a letter to ACARA, who is the Australian Curriculum Authority, and just put together really succinctly the research and evidence. And they were actually really fabulous. They listened to all of our concerns and created a curriculum connection on food and nutrition. So in the past, before version 9 of the Australian curriculum was released, if you have done a search, luckily Kylie did for BMI, in the Australian curriculum, there were around 340 times that it was kind of mentioned offhand in across a whole range of different key learning areas. And now if you do a search, you get just one result, and that leads you to this curriculum connection document that says, please don't get young people to measure or compare their BMI. It was really never designed for use at the individual level anyway, let alone for us to be linking it so closely to health. So we call this the Bye Bye BMI campaign. And that curriculum change was kind of published in November. No one even thought about it because everyone was off on holidays and Christmas. But then in January, it sort of got picked up in the media, and, you know, a whole lot of people had a whole lot of opinions about it, of course. But I think that at the really simple level, we're just trying to get across that there are a whole lot of activities and approaches, particularly in food and nutrition education and the way that we talk about food, that just aren't working for anyone. And they can be problematic and be potentially triggering for eating disorders. And so in order to keep all of our students safe, there are some small changes that we need to make to the way that we talk about food. And it might mean just switching out one class activity that you've been doing for a really long time, but that's going to make food nutrition education more inclusive for everyone.
From our conversation today, and for me, I'm so surprised that from as young as 3, the research shows that children start to become aware of body size and body image. Your resources, are they tailored for this really young age group as well?
It surprised me too. We kept doing research with younger and younger children, and it was like sometimes some of the 3-year-olds could not put a sentence together, and yet they were really demonstrating these very clear ideas about bodies. And so it sort of started to get to the point where it's like, okay, I don't think we can deliver anything directly to the 3-year-olds, but what we can do is to really empower the educators around them and the parents around them to be able to be role modeling and talking about food and bodies in ways that might make a difference. And a lot of this was drawn from, you know, the research that informed the Confident Body, Confident Child program, which had some 10 years of research, my colleague Laura Hart at Melbourne Uni. And so we really created some resources for the early childhood educators to just update a few things. You know, one of the main things that we hear is that educators are talking about good foods and bad foods, which, like, when you're trying to break down nutrition education for a 3-year-old, like, that's where you go because it's simple, right? But when we start to talk about good foods and bad foods, those, that sort of gives like a moral value to that food and to the people who are eating them. And so for those really concrete thinkers at that very early age, it can be problematic. So the Body Blocks program is just some really short modules for early childhood educators. We're talking like 5 minutes in the tea room. You can watch a really quick video and then go back out on the floor and implement some really practical strategies in terms of the way that you speak about food, about bodies, about your own body, about even play food, play dough, play bodies, all of the things. So just some really easy, straightforward tips, and then some resources that you can use in the classroom as well. So it's something that a lot of early childhood educators are really aware of, the fact that they're talking about food a lot, but they're probably not so aware about talking about bodies. And this resource brings those two things together just to make sure that we're creating those really positive relationships with food and bodies for the young people in our care right from the very beginning of their lives.
And how fantastic that these resources are now available to our educators who we know are busy and potentially time poor. So it's fantastic to hear that these resources are available for everyone to use.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We know teachers have 1,000 different things on their plate. And, you know, this is just one of those things, but there are just a few key things. You know, it's sort of become like not many schools would be weighing students anymore. And there's a few of these key activities that we just need to move in that same direction where it just sort of becomes out of practice.
Oh, that's fantastic, Zali. And we'll have links to all these resources in our show notes for anyone who would like more information. So thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure and fascinating to hear about the research and how fantastic that we're moving in a different direction with all of this. So I take my hat off. What a great initiative you've started in the Embrace Collective.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. If you would like to keep up to date with our latest conversations, we'd love it if you liked and subscribed to our Emerging Minds Families podcast channel. You can also find us on Instagram at Emerging Minds AU or on Facebook at Emerging Minds Families. You have been listening to an Emerging Minds Families podcast. If anything spoken about in today's episode has been distressing for you or you find yourself struggling, please reach out for help. You can call Lifeline on 131114 or more resources for support can be found in our show notes.
Visit our website at www.emergingminds.com.au to access a range of resources to assist your practice. Brought to you by the National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health, led by Emerging Minds. The National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health under the National Support for Child and Youth Mental Health Programme.